Disclosure: the information in this podcast is educational and general in nature and does not take into consideration the listener's personal circumstances. Therefore, any and all information presented in this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for specific individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making any decision. How's it going, guys? Ben Keady here with the Wealth Crypto Podcast, and this time my guest is Adam Vandenbogaard. He is the co-head of sales at Copper. Copper, for those who don't know, is essentially a crypto custodial business, but they also do a lot of other work for infrastructure layers for people who are interested in building crypto businesses. So they have a really great seat to sort of see everything that's going on in the space right now, particularly from an institutional perspective. Adam also, separately, is an ex-Navy fighter pilot, so he is the one and only fighter pilot we've had on the podcast so far. So without much further ado, hope you guys enjoy. Thanks. Okay, and we are live. Adam, thanks for joining, man.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Appreciate it. Excited to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to hop on. I think joining a distinguished list of former guests. So excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're adding to it. I'm excited to get into this today. But maybe just give a brief, like, sort of intro overview of who you are and what you're up to currently, and then we can just go from there.
Yeah, super high level. Probably the only combat Navy veteran who's been on the show in the past.
You're for sure the only one.
Former fighter pilot instructor, ex-Wall Streeter, and currently co-head of sales for the Americas region at Copper. So that's U.S., Canada, Latin America, Caribbean. And Copper's a digital asset infrastructure technology company. So super high level, that's me in a nutshell.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty concise. Some people kind of wax infinite there. But let's see, I mean, maybe just start real quick with just, for people who don't know, what does Copper do? And we can kind of explore from there.
Yeah, so Copper is a digital asset infrastructure provider. So foundationally built on the idea of custody. We started in late 2017, early 2018. The tagline is building the institutional standard for digital assets. Custody is foundational to that, and then it's really a number of kind of value-add services that sit on top of that. Digital asset infrastructure company. The focus for us is purely institutional, so there's no retail component to what we do. It's really designed to help institutional investors safely acquire, trade, settle, store digital assets and crypto assets. So there's a pretty comprehensive suite of custody, trading, clearance, and settlement. We build in a governance framework, permissioning for different institutions. There's treasury management, collateral management functionality. And then kind of in general, a prime services offering. So Copper has been named best digital asset custodian every year since 2019. I think for us, the crux of the value proposition is really focused on the idea of reducing and mitigating counterparty risk for our clients. So it's really looking at bringing greater capital efficiency and greater operational efficiency into the digital asset markets. Okay. We have a flagship product that most folks are probably aware of called Clearloop. So in addition to kind of the custodial foundation of what we do, Clearloop is our off-exchange collateral management and settlement solution. It enables our clients to essentially delegate is the term that we use. So you can delegate funds and trade on and across multiple partner exchanges. So on the centralized exchange side, so what you do is you can move assets essentially off chain to the exchange. The settlements occur across the Copper infrastructure, and it essentially enables managers to kind of mitigate exchange counterparty risk because you don't have to pre-fund the exchange with those assets. It fosters, greater capital efficiency, and it, essentially enables that access to liquidity across those trading venues. You can do it swiftly, you can do it securely, and you get to do it, all within the protections of a bankruptcy remote trust structure designed essentially to address the insolvency risk of all of the Clearloop participants, whether it's Copper, the Copper client, or the exchange itself.
Okay. That's a pretty comprehensive little overview. Where, I mean, how long have you been with Cocker now?
Timing on that was very interesting. I joined Cocker 2 years ago, so early 2022.
Great time.
Made the move over from the traditional finance world. So, I was with a tier one investment bank on the prime brokerage side of things. Had been there for a bit, and decided to make the jump into the digital asset space a couple of months before what would end up being, I think, one of the worst bear markets on record and downfall of some major platforms across the space. So a couple of months ahead of Terra Luna, and then it was Three Arrows, and then it was Voyager, then Celsius, then FTX and BlockFi. So it was one colossal failure after another shortly after stepping into the space. So it's been an interesting 2 year ride for sure. And it's probably similar timeline to when you kind of started getting into the podcast piece as well, I would imagine. So we've probably both taken a similar ride.
Yeah. You know, actually that's definitely true. I mean, I'd been invested before. My first investment was in 2017, but I really kind of jumped in later. The podcast started basically 2 years ago, 2 years ago in May coming up. And it was interesting times. I actually had on a guy who had just left Celsius at the time. We didn't get too deep into what was going on there because he, wanted to maintain relationships and all that sort of stuff. But crazy time. I remember looking and I was like, how in the world are they offering me a 20% yield? And and I was just looking through it and trying to figure out exactly what they were doing. And obviously disclosures were super limited. So I knew I was kind of like, this is a black box. And they're probably doing something that is pretty wild to give you a 20% yield. So I think I'm not going to be a part of this.
I think if we have any positive takeaways over the past 2 years, it's that hopefully a lot of that type of stuff has been kind of fleshed out of the industry. So I'd like to think that, we're still a nascent industry, but we're moving progressively forward, and hopefully the cleanup of some of that in the space is a net positive for the ecosystem as a whole.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's kind of interesting because like that last year was definitely rough to a degree, right? Like everything slowed down. I've got friends on sort of the hedge fund side of the business who have just been saying raising money the last like year and a half has just been a pain. Like they just, it's just not really happening. But it would appear we've got a pretty pretty good outlook for 2024 right now. Obviously things can change, no one knows the future, but things appear positive. So I'm curious, how is sort of, I guess, sentiment impacting what you guys are doing at Copper? I assume you're generally getting more institutional kind of demos, sales calls, questions.
It's interesting you mentioned the VC side of things. We work obviously with a lot of VCs. We work with a lot of hedge funds, a lot of foundations. And when I say foundation, I mean kind of layer one folks that are building in the space. We participated a few weeks ago in an event out of Lake Tahoe called Crypto Peaks, which as a snowboarder, you would appreciate. We spent a couple of days at Palisades Tahoe. And it was a great event put on by the Lattice VC guys, but it's a great opportunity for kind of VC centric folks, for funds, for builders, and everybody to kind of get together and ski and hang out and kind of talk shop collectively. So I think we're seeing a good shift, as you mentioned, where for the past 18 to 24 months, it's been really, really hard for firms to raise capital. I think we're starting to see that kind of turn around a little bit, which is exciting. Sure. So we're definitely seeing, we do a little bit of kind of cap intro as part of our consulting services at Copper. So we definitely we've got our ear to the ground on that side of things. We're definitely seeing those conversations pick up between VCs and funds broadly. And then I think just in general, you saw a pretty significant retreat from the marketplace over the past 2 years, from the institutional perspective. You felt like the institutions were just there on the cusp and right kind of on the verge of really diving in. Yeah. And then as we talked about, one colossal failure after another, I think a lot of folks got gun shy. So we saw a pretty significant pullback from institutional interest over the past couple of months. That sentiment is also, changing very dramatically. So folks where we had had conversations with previously, those are picking back up. New conversations that we hadn't started before are emerging. So it's nice to see that kind of just general institutional interest picking up pretty dramatically and in pretty short order. I think the ETF helps spurn a lot of that. You see growth in BTC prices, et cetera. This is, between last week and this week, we're flirting with all-time highs. So some very positive sentiment, which helps. I think the ETF was massive towards that as well. So definitely seeing the sentiment working in the direction that I think we all want it to.
For sure. What was I going to ask? I literally just lost it. I was curious about kind of how you guys, what does that mean? Is that like DeFi institutional native type stuff, or how much traditional finance are you seeing? And I guess kind of like in what avenues are people mostly engaging with you guys? Are people just trying to start funds?
Yeah, our client base is pretty varied across trading firms, hedge funds, asset managers, the foundations, the layer ones. So it's very robust and it's quite varied, which I think is really interesting. So you get to talk to a lot of different and interesting folks. From an institutional perspective, it's basically the whole world outside of retail. So it's anyone with, an LLC or any sort of kind of significant holding. So it's a lot of the hedge funds, it's a lot of the asset managers. We work with exchanges, market makers, et cetera. So basically anybody who touches the space with, large holdings, we're generally a pretty good fit for. I think there's a lot of uninvested institutional capital that exists within the space, particularly from a lot of those traditional financial institutions. I think a lot of those guys, as we were talking about, kind of were on the cusp of really diving in and have kind of pulled back a little bit, but I think they're reapproaching. I think there's, generally speaking, there's probably a couple of things in place that you need to have to really harness probably full scale institutional adoption. So to really get those folks, I think, comfortable deploying capital, there's a couple of things. Regulatory clarity is first and foremost for most folks. I think, comfort and appropriate risk mitigation processes, procedures, and partners in the space, being able to do that intelligently is very important. We've seen kind of renewed emphasis on, the nitty-gritty details in terms of the legal documentation, et cetera. Whereas, 2 years ago, folks were a little bit more laissez-faire, very, very detailed discussions on all of the different points, terms and conditions and all that kind of good stuff. And I think the other piece is, as we still as an industry work to kind of clean up the user experience, making that a bit more frictionless and a little bit more seamless. I think you get all of those things into line and you put yourself in a good position to see that institutional capital really flow in. When we talk about the pullback, I think one of the interesting spaces that we look at is like the pension, the sovereign wealth, the foundation endowment. And when I mean foundation endowment here, it's, institutions, not necessarily layer ones. But in the wake of FTX, two Novembers ago, we saw a really significant drawdown across the good examples, the Canadian pension plans. There was a pretty significant retreat from the crypto kind of world from that market segment. I think you're starting to see those types of investors starting to kind of creep back into the space, which is good. It's been, I think, to date, a pretty muted level of direct investment from those guys. I think I saw something on Bloomberg that said that basically the top 10 U.S. pension funds by assets, none of them are directly invested in Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies. I would guess that has changed a little bit with the launch of the ETFs. But the overall crypto exposure for that group, I think it's like 6,000 public sector plans. There's, global assets, something like 50 trillion. I think domestically it's like 6 trillion. So it's a massive segment of the market. I think when that market segment gets more involved, it'll be a pretty significant, you know, mover of the needle.
Yeah. I mean, do you guys have, I guess, much interaction with those like mega allocators, I guess? I mean, so I'm based in Sacramento. CalPERS and CalSTRS is in my backyard. They're huge, right? They're probably almost, what are they? Probably like a trillion between the two of them. Yeah. Right. And even getting, you know, like a 1 or 2% slug would be incredible, right? Where do you think you kind of touched on this earlier? You said that there are a couple of things that might not be quite ready yet for, I guess, maybe those top tier allocators. What are those things again? And then, how do you kind of benchmark this? Like, how far out? Like, what needs to happen to make it? Make it work.
Yeah, I think there's a number of challenges and kind of pain points, and probably the bigger ones, you know, I think I always have to kind of remind myself too that we're in still early days, I think, of the industry as a whole. Still early days for institutional adoption, and I think even earlier days for kind of institutional adoption to DeFi. I think that's
sure.
Certainly further down the road. It's a nascent market. The white paper came out in 2008, right? Satoshi's paper. It's a 15-year-old industry, so we're still very much a teenager as sure. an industry. So in some ways, we still kind of act that way, I think. So market fragmentation is a problem. User experience, I think, is a problem. Areas that need some improvement and need to be addressed. I think the importance of giving, you know, managers and institutional users a simple and kind of secure way to transact and to do it across blockchains is super important for growth and scalability of the space.
Sure.
I think for institutional adoption to really take off, right, it's those three things, right? It's reg clarity. That's probably the biggest one. You know, you have to know what the rules are so that you can follow them. And I think most folks agree that having that reg clarity, you know, domestically is really important to the growth of the ecosystem. You know, you have to have that strong grasp and be comfortable with the types and the level of associated risk that you're, you know, encountering in the space. And then to be able to effectively manage that both proprietarily and through the partners that you work with, when, you know, within the industry. And that's kind of where Copper prides itself on, on being a mature kind of industry participant.
Sure.
And then kind of a frictionless and seamless user interface, I think, is a big one before, right? I think what folks largely want is this idea of indifference. So indifference between the way that they transact with their traditional assets and the way that they transact with their digital assets, cognizant that there's, you know, pretty significant kind of you know, structural differences in terms of the way those markets work. But they want a similar user experience. They want that experience to be relatively seamless. So if we can address those three kind of, you know, keys to adoption, I think we put ourselves in a good spot.
Yeah. Yeah. You bring up an interesting point about keeping things similar across how people run their business. So like for my day job at SS&C, like one of the big themes is sort of all-in-one investment operations across asset classes and time zones and platforms and all this sort of stuff. Like, the industry's kind of grown up in this world where everyone got like best of breed sort of point solutions, which was fine when you're smaller. But as you scale out, oftentimes these things aren't built really to integrate and scale efficiently. So you've got multiple logins, multiple vendors, multiple processes, like, you know, you're getting a lot of data breaks, things aren't like syncing up correctly. And all of a sudden it's a bigger headache than it needs to be. And then I can particularly see as an institution, like now you want to bolt on crypto, maybe DeFi. How do you do that? Like, what exactly is the solution there to really kind of integrate, say, like a 2% allocation of crypto into, say, your portfolio metrics for, like, you know, a balanced portfolio? Like, how do you do
that? Yeah, it's exceedingly challenging, right? I think the crypto native folks have a leg up in that regard because it's more second nature to them. I think it's a bit more challenging for the more traditional players in the space to get comfortable with it and to get used to it. So it's a bigger lift for those guys. And we spend a pretty significant amount of our time educating. So it's educating the crypto native guys on the more kind of traditional market structure and finance aspects. And then conversely, for the traditional guys, is trying to teach them the more crypto native aspect of the nuance of the industry. So we do spend a significant part of our day on kind of just educating the market in general. You know, highlighting best practices and you know, really highlighting the impact and benefit of some of the the risk mitigation pieces. So that's a big part of it is purely just education, because there is going to be some separate build out that you're going to have to do, because those two worlds don't necessarily communicate all that well together just yet. But I think we're getting there, right? There's always going to be the struggle within the digital space, kind of the ease of on and off ramping rails. It seems like such a simple problem to have. Just how do I get my fiat into crypto? How do I get my crypto back into fiat if I want to do that? And then the other thing the folks struggle with, right, is just reliable banking partners. We had the banking crisis just about a year ago at this point. So having a more robust infrastructure, kind of in those areas is going to be helpful, right? I think the idea of if we can mature as an industry to get to a point of like true cross margin functionality, that's very interesting, right? The fractured ecosystem that we've talked a little bit about makes that really difficult. But taking, from the traditional world, a true prime broker in the traditional sense, where you could in theory cross margin across the digital asset space, and then take it a step further where now, hey, I can cross margin across my traditional book and my crypto book. That sort of things, I think, get really interesting for the space, and you start to see it grow up and become more than just a 1-5% allocation within the portfolio.
Interesting. Let's see. So we paused out there for a sec. I wanted to kind of go back to the banking piece, because I feel like that's kind of like in the background that people aren't paying. I guess I'm sure people in the space are actually really paying attention to it, but like in terms of on off ramps for, to make things easier. What is the current status of banking here in the US for crypto businesses? Like, obviously that'll be a big part of the regulation that we want clarified, but what do you guys think needs to happen to sort of allow banks to, enter this business and be a little bit more diversified?
Yeah, it's still a huge challenge. I think we have to get over the volatility piece. So folks have to get comfortable with that aspect of it. I think for Copper's an international institution, we're London based. Our clients face off with our Swiss entity, so we benefit from the international component, where the world of banking partners is much more robust for us, and we leverage the services of a number of them as, again, a kind of a risk mitigation tool. For U.S. domestic full setups, the banking piece is a significant challenge. We see that across funds. We see that, across folks in the space, where you'll have banks that say we're not servicing crypto-related business, and it's just a hard stop. So that I think we've got a long way to go before that gets sorted. But I think that will be, to your point, kind of part and parcel to the regulatory setup.
Do you guys have opinions on like what needs to happen in the US from a regulatory standpoint that would sort of move the ball forward? Or do you guys maybe stay out of the regulatory debate?
Yeah, I mean, I think we try to largely, I think, stay out of it. I think we have to work within the confines that we're given to a certain extent. I think generally everybody in the space agrees that regulatory clarity in the US is super important. There was a Chainalysis report that came out not long ago that said, despite regulatory uncertainty, the US drives, I think it's the greatest share of crypto activity in the world. So it's over like $1 trillion in transaction volume over the course of like 2022 into 2023. And the US alone accounts for like a quarter of the global transaction volume. And that transaction volume is largely driven by institutional investors and managers. So the key driver of that activity, I think 80% of transactions were transfers of $1 million or more. So this stuff is actually happening despite the lack of regulatory clarity, right? With the most active institutional investors in crypto, we dominate, the global DeFi volume. So I think, say what you will about U.S. regulatory uncertainty. I think, you know, the U.S. is and will maintain, you know, kind of that center global hub of that activity. I think clarity helps to further that adoption. But, you know, it's, you know, that adoption is not only is it growing globally, but it's growing very much domestically. You know, we are seeing, of course, to a certain extent, folks looking to establish setups offshore. And I think, you know, the U.S. will remain, at least for the foreseeable future, the, you know, financial capital and most dominant, you know, kind of player in the space. But there's some interesting stuff going on in terms of people having conversations about, do we make an offshore movement to Europe? Do we go to APAC? Do we go to the Middle East? Latin America is a very interesting one. We see that as kind of emerging as a significant player in the space. And it makes a lot of sense, right? There's an obvious use case for folks in Latin America. There's, you know, distrust in the government. There's you're using it, you know, digital assets as protection against, you know, rampant inflation. So the use cases down in Latin America are very real. It's, you know, certainly much less a speculative asset and much more a very useful tool for everyday life. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, no, it's definitely an interesting point to kind of think about, like how and why people are using crypto in various places globally. Like the U.S., you know, for better or for worse, is a speculative asset. People are ape trading into, you know, ape pictures and, you know, shit coins and stuff. And but globally, like Latin America is a great example. Like it's actually very real on the ground. And I'm curious to see, now that I think about it, how infrastructure, products, services will develop over time, given how it's actually used day to day. If you kind of extract, like if I kind of think about it, like if you've got, my assumption, I guess, is best case scenario is more people use crypto and understand sort of foundational principles of DeFi and wallets and et cetera, et cetera. And if you've got a greater percentage of the public using these things and understanding these things, you're probably going to get over time a more dynamic sort of market. Whereas, you know, in the US, like I feel like, you know, for better or for worse, we have a very sort of efficient banking system that people are used to. So adoption for crypto and wallets and, you know, DeFi protocols is going to be probably more difficult than places where, you know, by necessity, you have to figure it out, I guess. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, kind of rambling, but
yeah, I mean, I think that retail adoption ultimately drives the institutional adoption to a certain extent. So I think that's part of it. And I think that's what I think got me interested in the space to begin with. So at the bank on the prime brokerage side, you know, completely separate from the crypto world, a very equity prime brokerage focused model. We had significant clients, hedge funds, asset managers, market makers that would come to us and say, "Hey, we're interested in this crypto thing. How do we get started? What do we do?" And the overall sentiment at the bank was, "Well, if you want to do it, you need to do it away from us." So you're kind of to a certain extent sending business. Exactly. So, but it was the consistent ask and the persistence of some of the largest, you know, players in the space where I kind of realized, okay, this is something that really has legs when the true kind of traditional institutional players really dive in. That's where this makes a, you know, a hockey stick kind of move. So, was those guys that I think got me kind of over the hurdle. I was not, it was probably more of a cynic than anything else, but the interest that those folks had in it was infectious, I think, and steered the drive into the space.
So I wanted to ask, like, what got you into crypto? So you were on your job on Wall Street doing prime brokerage, and you started from clients and prospects just hearing, "Hey, are you paying attention? We're kind of interested in this. Do you guys have a view?" type thing. That was kind of how it went, I guess.
Yeah, it was a lot of those guys seeing the question on a regular basis, trying to say, "Hey, we want to do this. We want to get into it. We don't know how." And you know, we made kind of initial steps to try to step into the space at a very small scale for a very small, you know, percentage of our client base. But you knew that they were setting up, you know, separate crypto trading desks and doing all these different kind of things. to get exposure in the space. And you knew that they were doing it through other avenues, whether it was DeFi, they were doing stuff offshore, they were getting set up. But you knew that that infrastructure had to apply to them. And you know, Copper, I thought was an interesting one that had been, you know, a couple steps ahead of a lot of the other folks in the space in terms of the way that they had built out their product. And it was very interesting to me. So, you know, infrastructure was an interesting play coming from kind of the banking and prime brokerage world, because it's such an integral part of what an institution is going to do. So
sure.
That to me made kind of, it was an easy transition from kind of traditional equity prime brokerage into where we're building out a more kind of traditional prime services setup at Copper.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that, I mean, that's kind of a logical transition. Pipes and plumbing are basically required, you know, whether it's on Wall Street or in DeFi, like you still need to be able to, you know, do your accounting, do your risk and performance, do, you know, the basics of the business. So now that you've been at Copper, I guess, for a little while, what do you guys think are sort of key themes for 2024? Like, what are you guys really focusing on?
Yeah, I think the off-exchange settlement piece is massive for us. So the growth in Clearloop, we're on a weekly basis setting all-time highs across volumes, across delegated balances, across initial margin. So continuing to grow that ecosystem is big. I think you're starting to see a maturation of the marketplace in general. A good example of that is we actually announced relatively recently that we would open up Clearloop to be kind of custodian agnostic. So the idea being that you could partner with a BitGo, a Komainu, a Zodia to offer those clients who are holding assets in their custody to leverage the rails that we've built out across Clearloop so that they could, in a similar fashion, delegate balances while keeping assets with a custodian. So that's a really interesting kind of partnership, whereas, you know, there's competition, obviously, in the industry. But the idea of providing managers with kind of a custodian agnostic approach to mitigating exchange counterparty risk is, I would argue, a net benefit for the ecosystem as a whole, right? So we're super proud to partner with BitGo, with Komainu, with Zodia, and really kind of facilitate that growth within the institutional marketplace. The idea of kind of de-risking trading market environments, I think, is a big push for us. And to do that on a grander scale and make that more custodian agnostic is really exciting. So you'll see continued growth, certainly for 2024 in that ecosystem. We just printed, I think, our first test trade for our agency lending setup, which will, you know, kind of step into the place, you know, where some key market participants who had been kind of on the borrow lend side of things were there are no longer there. So there's massive demand for borrow. We've got significant interest from lenders to kind of step into that space. So Copper's excited to kind of step into an agency capacity, facilitating, you know, without any sort of balance sheet risk, the ability to help facilitate some of that borrow lend within the space. You know, any way you can kind of increase liquidity is a net positive as well. So we're excited for those. Are probably the two biggest drivers, I think, in 2024.
So when you
very
say
excited on those fronts.
When you say borrow lend, are you talking, I guess, specifically about just trading on margin, or are you talking about other, like, how do you define borrow lend?
Yeah, so Copper won't extend any sort of leverage or kind of balance sheet into the space. So that's what you would typically see from kind of a more traditional prime broker. But there's a lot of folks, you know, those sovereign wealth funds, pensions, et cetera, who may have, you know, a considerable stockpile that they want to loan out at a certain rate of interest. And a lot of folks looking to, you know, essentially lever up based on those borrows. So it's the idea of just putting those two folks together and facilitating those movements is very interesting. And then kind of taking it a next step, leveraging that Clearloop infrastructure as well to do the borrow lend in kind of a closed ecosystem is very interesting as well. You start to you know, multiply the effects of the counterparty risk mitigation piece of Clearloop when you factor in the borrow lend component to it.
Interesting. So do you guys like do you guys have like a preferred, I guess, kind of way of like maybe even like a preferred client? Like, do you tend to take the view that like financial institutions generally are going to move more crypto native over time, or do you kind of have, like maybe more of a TradFi lean? Where I guess do you see these things down the road sort of integrating to, and then what kind of, efficiencies do you see maybe particularly from the TradFi to DeFi side? How do you envision your business evolving over time with these two components?
Yeah, I think when we look at it longer term, I think the view is maybe even more progressive than that. You're not going to have the digital asset market and the traditional market. You'll just have the market. You'll have just a complete blend of these two worlds in a lot of different ways. So a lot of the infrastructure can be leveraged. A lot of the existing equity and fixed income is going to become more digitized and more kind of blockchain centric. And the digital asset piece kind of rolls into that as well. So I think there'll be a confluence of both of those worlds in the longer term. I don't think that happens in the next 3 to 5 years, but I think largely you'll see that kind of, you'll see the coming together of those two things. There was an announcement out of the UK relatively recently that I thought was kind of went under the radar, but basically the FCA in the UK and the Bank of England kicked off. There was a consultation process to look at stablecoin regulation. The idea behind that was to effectively look at how they could ensure the secure and system-wide usage of stables as kind of a future payment system. So a little bit of a progressive look at the central bank looking at stablecoins likely being used widely for payments in the future. So I think you'll start to see those worlds kind of combine to a certain extent globally, which is excitement, right? The idea of using stables as an everyday form of payment to a certain extent already exists in Latin America, but when you have major European players starting to look more seriously at it, I think it's a good sign.
Yeah. Do you guys do like much consulting with clients on things that they're thinking about that are interesting, whether it's stables or a protocol or some other thing? What are interesting things that you guys are helping to facilitate with your clients?
I think one of the benefits of having a pretty diverse client base is that we get to have a lot of those kind of exciting, what can we build together conversations. We always look at that regardless of the client type. So we build out support across kind of the layer one foundation ecosystem. So we have a lot of conversations with that. There's an entire flywheel that we have dedicated to what it means to be able to provide custodial support, to bring them into the platform, to expose them to, other funds, VCs, and kind of open up the world of custody for the other institutional clients that we have. A lot of kind of capital introduction that we do a little bit more informally across the team. So there's a significant portion of the business that's related to some of those consulting efforts that we do kind of regardless of where the firms are located and what kind of firm they happen to be. So we have conversations across foundations, asset managers, hedge funds, et cetera. So it's pretty varied, and we're well positioned, I think, with a good reputation in the digital asset space to help folks, especially who are more traditional, even retail folks, we have conversations with about, what's their digital strategy going to look like? How do you build that out? And how do you do it intelligently within a good kind of risk mindset? So those conversations are something we have regularly with a lot of different folks in the space.
Do you guys put out like your own research too? Or like own opinions on things, or is that not where you guys play?
We do, yeah. So there's some proprietary research that we put out on a monthly basis. We recently launched what we're calling Opening Bell, which is going to be a weekly research piece. So it's got quick snippets of all the different stuff that we're seeing within kind of the broader kind of crypto marketplace. I think that gets published on LinkedIn every Monday. So you can sign up for that to just get delivered straight to your inbox, which is nice. But those type of research piece and being not content focused, but I think content conscious and being able to put out what we're seeing in the marketplace as we find it interesting, I think is it's a nice value add that you know we include in kind of the overall client experience.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I bet it helps from the sales side, right? Just having some stuff to
touch. It's always so. I mean, it's always nice to have content that's thoughtful and you know provocative sometimes that you can send out and get opinion on. And use as an opening to a conversation to say, hey, look at what we just put out, interested in your thoughts. And then, you know, how you can tie the existing client base, the existing product suite all together. And in that I think is, it's a great tool to have for a sales team for sure.
Yeah. What's it been like, kind of stepping into a head of sales role coming from, I mean, kind of doing the same thing, but you're kind of going from traditional financial services, Wall Street to sort of technology, established technology startup, crypto. Like, what has that transition been like for you?
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And probably an easier transition than I thought it might be, which was why going with an infrastructure provider, I think, in the crypto space made a lot of sense. What I probably enjoyed the most on the prime brokerage side was some of that organic growth that we were able to do, where it was you're really diving deep with the respective clients that you're working with, figuring out what the pain points are and figuring out where there are, you know, maybe solutions that you have that could apply to them that they're not actively leveraging. So that aspect of the role I probably enjoyed more than anything else. And that's now essentially what we do kind of on a full-time gig on the sales side here. So it's really looking at how does the current offering match up with what the needs are and how can we kind of tailor that to make it the most value add to underlying clients. So that part is very translatable and easy to, you know, made that jump into kind of the crypto sales piece relatively easy.
Yeah. Maybe a little bit more of a stretch. How does your fighter pilot background sort of inform what you do day to day? Like, is there any comparisons or are they too high level there?
No, I mean, I think there's definitely transferable skill sets. I think more than anything, it's always the ability to kind of recognize what's a big problem, what's a small problem, and to be able to kind of prioritize. I think that's probably first and foremost. In aviation, it's all about planning, preparation, execution, and then debrief. And I try to take a very similar mindset to what we do here. So we always argued that, you know, the debrief was the most important component of a flight, because that's where you tend to learn the most. Is okay. Revisiting your successes, revisiting your failures, and having kind of open lines of communication around that. So I try to take a very similar approach with the team here at Copper, in terms of the sales team domestically to go through, you know, and be process oriented in terms of how we do things, and then sure. Be smart about, you know, how we review again successes and failures and how do you learn from them.
What was a failure for you guys that you had to turn around and address and sort of building out the business the last couple of years? Like, walk me through something that didn't go well.
We've been, I think, as a firm, very fortunate. We've been well positioned on the charging model, the diversity of client base. So we've been very fortunate that through a very kind of dark and brooding bear market that we've come out well. And I think it's a testament to the thoughtfulness of the team in terms of how they built that product suite to kind of take digital assets into kind of the next phase of growth for the ecosystem as a whole. So we've been very fortunate in that, you know, we've tried to look at how do we bring kind of the best of TradFi into the crypto space. How do you build out, you know, the most secure financial market infrastructure that you can? So having that in place has been hugely beneficial to us. And I think some of the things, you know, well beyond our control have played into that well. It's part of why Clearloop has become what it has become in the past year and a half, right? Some of the spectacular failures on the exchange side highlight a risk that folks assumed wasn't really there, or chose not to, you know, to to dig into a lot. So having the foresight to set up the product the way that we did has positioned us, I think, very well to not have to deal with some of the negative ramifications of what happened to the broader marketplace. So
yeah,
we've been fortunate. That's for sure. But it's been fortunate by design and through thoughtful preparation and build out. So
there you go. There you go. Let's see, let maybe turn it around a bit. I mean, sometimes I do this. Do you have any questions or thoughts for me?
Yeah, you've been doing this for 2 years. I would be very interested in the progression of themes across themes and sentiment, maybe across the guests that you've had. How has that changed over the past 2 years? Are there any recurring themes that you see, or how have they changed over time?
Well, sentiment I'll start with, because that's an easy one. It was basically rock bottom when I started. So sentiment has continued to go up, but you know, it's kind of interesting as far as the sentiment piece goes. If I think back to like last summer, even further back, like the people in the space were frustrated, yes, that like particularly Sam got sort of the clout that he did and then ended up being such a black eye for the industry, because I remember listening to, who was it? I think it was Eric Voorhees on Bankless, like literally right before, I think, that FTX blow up or something. But he was talking, just like people in the industry felt like Sam was lobbying for regulation that benefited him and FTX alone, right? But I guess this is a long-winded answer way to say that people in the know were frustrated with those blowups, but they were also optimistic about what they were doing and what they were building. Like all those blowups, the biggest thing in common with them is that they were all centralized versions of a business that were black boxes. They're no different than like Bernie Madoff or almost any bank. So like people in the space, while frustrated, yes, were still optimistic about the promise of what they were building. So that was interesting. I mean, as far as themes go, I feel like last year I spoke a lot about stable coins for sure. Like that definitely was a topic. A little bit too about sort of user interface is a big piece. So like over time, things have gotten easier, I think, in crypto to move things around and sort of execute between chains and between wallets. And it wasn't as fragmented as, it's certainly not as fragmented as it used to be. But I think one thing that everyone is kind of innately aware of is that like while the user interface and experience for sort of crypto native people is fine, it's not great for the rest of the market, right? So like those on-ramps, off-ramps, how you move money around the space, and what level of, I guess, inherent risk or control you want to take, I think is an important question. Because not everyone wants to own their private keys and then, you know, if they mess up, just lose a wallet or, you know, send ETH to a Bitcoin address or whatever. So, I don't know, stablecoins, summarize it, I guess, stablecoins, the user interface, regulation is a big one too, right? Like everyone's kind of, but it depends though, right? Like you guys know, as global businesses, everyone's pretty optimistic. The European Union seemed to do pretty good with MiCA setting things up. You know, Dubai is apparently a huge hotspot for crypto. Switzerland apparently has a pretty thriving ecosystem. London too. Like, I kind of worry that the US might be getting a little left behind in regards to these businesses. But yeah, overall, people are generally positive and the industry seems to be moving forward, to your point earlier, with or without, you know, positive regulation in the US. So, yeah, I don't know. It's
an interesting company with a Swiss entity and an ADGM entity in Abu Dhabi. You know, we've recently kind of made that expansion into ADGM. It's definitely a part of part of the globe that's a bit more progressive, I think, in the way that they look at digital asset regulation. So we actually made a purchase or an acquisition towards the end of last year for Cryptocurrency Capital's tokenization engine and their broker-dealer entity there in ADGM. Okay. So that's something that we'll look towards, I think, for the later half of 2024 to build out as well, is the idea of you know, tokenized securities and how that could, you know, in theory, fit into kind of the Clearloop ecosystem is an interesting kind of next step for us in kind of our broader market maturation. And I think that speaks a lot to that confluence of traditional and digital assets that we talked about a little bit earlier. So, I think they're jurisdiction-wise well-positioned globally. I think the U.S. maintains its stronghold for a while. I don't know that we're necessarily at the point of losing that, but if we don't start to kind of, I think, get our act together, we certainly put that in jeopardy.
Yeah. It's funny. I think this occurred to me last year because I personally don't know how we get away with spending so much money here in the U.S. And I mean, go figure. That's a question for politicians. But I think it's highly ironic that, like, the solution that I view to, demand for the dollar and keeping rates low and enabling us to continue to borrow at exorbitant rates might actually be tokenized treasuries, like exporting the dollar in a tokenized treasury to a retail global market seems to be like a no-brainer if I'm in the U.S. Treasury, right? But, who knows? Who knows, I guess. But it'll be interesting to see kind of how the U.S. plays out. Like, we've got to obviously get through this election here and see what happens, and then we'll see about regulation from there. But, while it might be a big deal for us, I'm sure Washington has other priorities as far as regulation goes. So who knows what? We might be in limbo for a little while.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, right, the Bitcoin spot ETF is a great step in the right direction. So we're trending positively, which is a good thing, right? I think we'll look back and say this is very much a defining moment for the digital asset ecosystem. It's very much a game-changing kind of setup for the industry at large, right? You look at, the ETF marketplace is like $7 trillion in the U.S. It's multiples the size of Europe's and APAC. So we do kind of lead the charge there, which is a good thing, right? I think it's like $50 trillion in terms of assets managed across, the broker-dealer entities, the banks, the RIAs. So really just a small percentage of I think, managed and kind of brokerage assets moving into spot BTC ETFs is a big needle mover. We kind of talked a little bit about some of the pension sovereign wealth as well. It's another kind of marketplace that's interesting there. I think it was the folks at GSR put out a good kind of opinion piece that talked about kind of benefits of, the spot BTC ETF doing a couple of different things. And I think it trends the needle in the right way. It gives Bitcoin legitimacy. It, helps to eliminate some of that regulatory uncertainty. It gives, certainly some credibility to crypto as an asset class, as kind of a standalone asset class. It gives the necessary, oversight and investor protections that we all think are important. And it does it in kind of a familiar and frankly, convenient vehicle to use. And then when you factor in, the names that are associated with it, right, the BlackRocks, the Fidelities, the Invescos, the Wisdom Trees, the VanEck in the space, guys with very, very solid reputations historically. And they also have exceptional, distribution networks and connections to advisors and the major wealth platforms. Oh, yeah. All of that lends itself, I think, very well to seeing this continue to flow well. We're starting to see the GBTC outflows slow down. We're seeing massive inflows. We're seeing great action, price-wise on BTC, so and crypto in general. So I think there's still a lot to be optimistic for as we kind of step forward. But I think this is maybe a good, initial step to start to knock down some of the dominoes on the regulatory front, at least.
Yeah. I think back to, what was it, last summer, I think, in the heat of sort of the ETF war with Gary. And I remember seeing the news that BlackRock was going to file hit the wire. And I was like, oh, this war is over. Like, as soon as I saw BlackRock enter the race, I was like, yeah, they're going to complain, but they're going to get out of the way of this because it's happening. And then there was some follow-up piece like a week or two later saying that BlackRock had only ever lost like one other ETF application, and that was based on like a compliance issue or something like that. So, that was all from James Seifert. I don't know if you follow him on Twitter, but he's a really good Bloomberg ETF analyst. That was great to follow during the approval process. So.
Yep, absolutely. Matt Levine put the crypto story, which was that kind of 40,000 word kind of breakdown. It was the kind of thing where I send it to family and friends and said, this is if you want a primer on digital assets and crypto, here's the place to start.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation about how to explain what crypto is to your friends and family who are not inclined. I don't know if you read the Bitcoin Standard by any chance.
I haven't.
That's a good one. Basically the idea is that you have to explain crypto, or at least Bitcoin specifically, you need to understand what money is first and why fiat is bad to a degree. And from there, provided you can get people to buy into that, all of a sudden hard assets as a store of value make a lot more sense. It's not just like, you know, internet money. So, but let's see, Adam, maybe I'll give you the last couple of minutes here to wrap up. Is there anything you kind of wanted to, close the loop on, or where people can follow you guys, what you guys are up to, any of that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. We're available copper.co, so copper.co. You can, on LinkedIn, Adam Vanden Bogart, if you can spell the last name, that's half the battle. Bogart is two O's and two A's. I'm at adam.vandenbogart@copper.co. Telegram's at Adam Vanden Bogart, so all very, very easy stuff. Go ahead and follow the Opening Bell weekly research piece that we've got available on LinkedIn. I don't know, big high-level closing remarks, probably just like I said, I have to remind myself, right? Still a nascent market. Satoshi's white paper came out in 2008. So we're a 15-year-old industry. We've siloed and fragmented in a lot of ways, and in many ways in our infancy, but that means there's a ton of room to grow, which is exciting, right? So I think from our perspective, the business of custody, which is, foundationally what Copper is built on, is, the idea of demonstrating this safe, stable, and kind of certain product. So that's really crucial. I think we talked a little bit about it, right? The institutional entrance into the digital asset market is I think still early days. We took a little bit of a hiatus over the past 2 years, but it feels like we're very much on the ramp up again, which is exciting. As I said, I think we're even earlier stages for the DeFi adoption at an institutional level. But oh, yeah. I think we'll get there. It may end up being a hybrid of the DeFi degens probably won't be happy and the traditional finance guys won't be happy. It'll be some sort of amalgamation meet in the middle. I think that means there's a lot of room for maturity. I think there's a lot of room for growth. I think you look at the headlines, there's a lot to be excited for. So we certainly are.
For sure. Well, we'll leave it there. Everyone go check out Copper. And if you want to buy something, call Adam. we'll leave it there.
Sounds good. Thanks, Ben.